broadcasting live from NPR's splendid studios in Washington, D.C., and we'll be talking with a man who helped shape the history of Indianapolis, Indiana, America, and the world over the last half of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. Former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar is my guest today. We won't be taking calls during this special broadcast, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We have a special No Limits today. We're broadcasting live from the fabulous NPR studios in Washington, D.C., courtesy of the great Washington, D.C. NPR team here, whom we must thank at the outset. We're also blessed to have as our guest former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Great to be with you again, John.
It is good to have you here. I'd like to say to our listeners, we won't be taking calls during this broadcast, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Senator, we probably ought to start this first by telling people what you are up to these days, because you didn't exactly slow down after you left the Senate.
We've just completed the fourth year of the Lugar Center, which is a junior think tank, so to speak. We have former staff members in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Agriculture Committee and other former staff members who just like to come by. But the specialists are continuing their research. They're organizing staff meetings with congressional staff and members, and likewise attempting to make an impact in the areas of arms control and food security around the world, the effectiveness of foreign aid, and more recently, bipartisan politics. We've come together in a partnership with the McCourt School of Georgetown University to compose what we call bipartisan indexes, in which we list all the members of the Senate from 1 to 100, all the members of the House of Representatives from 1 to 435, on the basis of the criteria of how many times have you offered legislation that got bipartisan support, somebody on the other side of the aisle politically, or how many times have you reached over to support somebody else's bill on the other side of the aisle. And we found that's a pretty good criteria to gauge the degree of cooperation and effectiveness of trying to get things done in the Congress.
Is that a top priority for you right now, to try to restore some sense of civility or cooperation to the process?
Yes, it is one of our top priorities. And the index has been taken very seriously by members of Congress. We publish one after each two-year session. And they know that the press back home in their districts or in their states are often publishing this and asking, why is my member this way or that way or so forth. At the same time, likewise, it gives them an incentive, really, to think about offering bills that might actually get passed, as opposed to simply being bills that are speeches that have really no relevance in terms of American politics or governance.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We're not taking calls during this broadcast, but you can join the conversation, as a listener named Jerry has done, by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Jerry writes, question for Senator Lugar. You worked closely for decades with Senate Democrats, from Sam Nunn to Barack Obama, to curb the dangers of nuclear weapons proliferation. In light of President-elect Trump's public statements, what is your candid assessment of current prospects for continuing nonpartisan cooperation in this vital area?
I have to believe the prospects are good because I'm an optimist, but likewise a realist. There is, I think, a recognition on the part of both Republicans and Democrats that even though through the Non-Lugar Crop Threat Reduction Act, roughly 10,000 Soviet Union, then Russian warheads aimed at the United States, every one of our cities, every one of our military installations, this has been cut down to, in the New START Treaty, to about 1,550 U.S. And Russian. And there, I think, is going to be a desire to think through whether we and the Russians should try to retain 1,550. I speak from the standpoint that these warheads have been refined to a point where I'm advised, and this is very dismal advice, that a single warhead, or at least two, are all you need to obliterate the whole city of Indianapolis, wipe it off the map. And that would be true of most cities in the United States, for that matter. So we're still armed with enough weaponry to obliterate each other's countries. That's very serious business. And this is why I'm pleased that several years ago, Sam Nunn, my partner in all of this, founded the so-called Nuclear Threat Initiative. It's a group that's international in scope. By that I mean there are board members from Russia, from China, from Pakistan, from India, from places that take nuclear weapons very seriously because they have them or they're worried about them. And there are meetings frequently trying to think through how much material, leaving aside warheads and missiles, but something nuclear material, chemical material, biological material that is deadly is in the hands of various countries. Now, the NTI has published a publication as a rule every year or every 2 years or so that really lists the countries and exactly what they have and the degree of safety. Now, that's very important, leaving aside nuclear threats. The fact is that terrorists, individuals or groups or so forth, could scoop up material in various places where people don't have adequate storage or safeguards and create havoc in various cities or various locations throughout the world. So this is a preoccupation of us, and this is one of the reasons why our Luger Center has continued really to work on the arms control thing through NTI and through other groups that have an interest in this.
Are you concerned, obviously, there have been reports that the Russian government hacked into our election system? I'm oversimplifying here, but then there's some evidence also that they were able to attack our power grid. President-elect Trump seemed to be somewhat dismissive of those concerns. Congress seems to be taking them far more seriously, and the intelligence community seems to be taking them far more seriously. Do you find that it's almost as if they're bipartisan and saying, okay, we need to deal with this? Do you find that to be a hopeful sign?
I think it's very hopeful that there is not only interest in it, but I'm hopeful beyond that, that there is a great deal of intelligence about really what is occurring. By that I mean we really are very vulnerable as a country to cyber attacks. We've had a lot of thoughts about the cyber attacks during the election period and some partisan debate about all of this. But leaving us that aside, is the fact that if people in one country or another want to disrupt the banking system of another country, or the hospital care, or the systems of health care, or all the coordinated efforts we now have, cyber attacks are a way of doing this and having devastating results on human beings wherever they may be. It's a different kind of warfare. It doesn't bring about battle fronts or a conventional dropping of bombs or even intercontinental ballistic missiles. It is electronic, cyber, and we're all going to have to become much more thoughtful and sophisticated about this, starting with our president and our members of Congress and those that are working with him. Now, there are a good number of people in this country who have given this a lot of thought, and I'm hopeful they will become a part of the conversation with the new administration very rapidly, because there is no time to waste in attempting to bring about as much protection as we can for all the communication systems that we have in this country that are vital.
Where did your interest in the security and foreign affairs issues spring from? Because you come from Indiana, which, you know, historically the Midwest has been kind of an isolationist part of the country, distrustful of foreign entanglements. And, you know, there weren't that many votes for you out of getting involved in those issues. There's even some evidence that it may have hurt you politically a time or two. What spurred your interest in you know, becoming what is an expert in these areas?
Well, if I'm trying to make a long story short, I'd not been outside the country until I was elected to become a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University in England. And this is a two-year study period. I went abroad, and while I was over there in England, traveled throughout Europe with other students, other groups of people, I really found out how big the world is, how diverse, how dangerous. I was immersed really day by day in all the problems of people who came from all sorts of countries. Other students would come from Africa or from Russia or from wherever. This led me to volunteer for duty in the United States Navy while I was still a Rhodes Scholar there in England. I was ordered to OCS, Officer Candidate School, at Newport, Rhode Island when I came back to the States, and then was plucked out of obscurity by Admiral Arleigh Burke, who was then Chief of Naval Operations, to become one of his intelligence briefers, to come in at midnight, read the secrets of the country, by 6 o'clock prepare a briefing, because the admirals wanted to know what I was going to say, in case Admiral Burke ordered a carrier around the Cape of Good Hope or what have you. At 8 o'clock, we would all march in, 50 admirals, and I would give the briefing. Usually go from there to CIA or to NSA and share at least what I knew with them and likewise. This went on for 3 years, very intense study of the world. And likewise, work with the Navy, but sometimes with the White House or the State Department or what have you, as the case may be. I came back to Indianapolis with my brother Tom Luger. We tried to save the Thomas L. Green Company on the West Side, which my grandfather had founded. And we did so largely through my brother's capabilities as a very gifted engineer, and our opportunities to sell our machinery abroad, first of all in Mexico, then in Latin America, then in the Philippines. I'll really cut to the chase right away. I want to say that we learned about commerce, about exporting. We learned about the rest of the world through other eyes other than the military. This has been on my mind ever since, and this is a rough sketch as to how this interest began.
What do you feel that the second part of that your interest and your devotion to these issues at times did cost you politically?
Well, I think that there were many people who felt that I ought to be interested in Indiana and exclusively Indiana and occasionally the rest of the country as it impacted upon our state. Others were not that focused, but nevertheless, some would say when they heard that I was going frequently to Russia or to Ukraine or Kazakhstan or Belarus to chase down after nuclear weapons and to keep pushing at least the parties there to do the right thing, that took time. And some would say, well, you should have been spending your time back in Indiana, not over there in Russia chasing nuclear weapons. So I could argue that it was very important, I felt, for the safety of all of us in Indiana, as well as the nation, for what we were doing, but it didn't sell with everybody. And, of course, in addition to that, I traveled widely in other continents as there were diplomatic or foreign policy or military problems. I was sent by presidents as we went through several administrations in those 36 years all over the world. I met with Muammar Gaddafi in a tent in Libya one time at the behest of the president at the time. These were things I felt were important for the country, a patriotic duty.
And I want to talk about that more. We are coming up on a break. I want to discuss really how you went about becoming perhaps the Senate's leading diplomat, almost like the Senate's version of a Secretary of State. If you are just joining us, we are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We're broadcasting live from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C. Because this is a special broadcast, we're not taking calls, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. Again, I am John Kroll. I'm talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're in the middle of a special live broadcast from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C. We're talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar about his career and some of the challenges that he has dealt with during that career. Because this is a special broadcast, we're not taking calls today, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. And to that point, we've gotten an email from a listener who writes, "Years ago, Mr. Lugar or his staff addressed my question on the viability of hemp legalization as not a viable business, as the reason that the plant is not legal. Does he still feel that there is no market for hemp or cannabis? Obviously, many states are legalizing cannabis and hemp for multiple benefits of their constituencies and countries. Black market laws exist because our government's lack of dedication to review and overturn outdated, ignorant, and often racist laws. Does Mr. Lugar feel he was on the wrong side of history as far as the cannabis legalization issue?" Senator?
Well, I'd like to know more about the research that's occurring right now on the cannabis issue, and it's an important one. Certainly a strong case is being made for medical use of marijuana in several parts of our country. That is different from recreational use of marijuana. I'm not certain the differentiation between cannabis pertains to marijuana and hemp production and what have you. Certainly at the time that I made those comments that the listener has talked about, it appeared to me that there was not a legitimate market, and that was at least the judgment I came to. But I think all of us are prepared, really, to listen carefully to what medical science may say and humane servants who are attempting to help people.
You take a very analytical approach to most issues, including ones like this one where people have really, really strong feelings. Is your goal when you do that, I'm assuming it's obviously to try to arrive at the right decision, but also to try to drain some of the emotion out of these hot-button issues?
Well, perhaps it drains the emotion. I think if people are emotional, they are likely to remain that way. I think that I speak on issues of this kind, hopefully, from a sense of conscience, from a sense of what is the right course to do for my family, for the ones that I love, and for all the people that I've tried to serve.
What started you on your career as a public servant? And I should tell our audience, in addition to this broadcast, we're working on doing a documentary that will appear on WFYI's TV site at some point on your life and career. So I've been talking to a lot of people who know you. And your wife, when I was talking with her yesterday, said it was clear from the moment you met, the two of you met and were involved, that this was going to be your life, that you were dedicated to doing this, that you had been raised and the idea of public service had really been inculcated into your being. Is that the case? Is she overstating it? Or is it this something you really always thought, this is what I want to do?
My parents, Marvin and Bertha Luger, were very interested in public life. They were not candidates for office, nor did they really serve as precinct committeemen or what have you. But I remember from the time that I was very young, 8 years of age, for example, in 1940, my dad allowed me to stay up with him and listen to Wendell Willkie being nominated as the presidential candidate of the Republican Party in 1940. It was 3 a.m. when the sixth ballot occurred and Willkie was the nominee. My parents went to Elwood to see the nominee, accept the nomination. My brother and I got down to the Monument Circle in Indianapolis. We wiggled our way because we were small boys all the way up underneath the balcony of the English Theater where the great man was speaking. And then Starr took a picture. And years later, I saw there we are, right under Willkie there. But I was excited by that and continue to be, really, as candidates and politics went on. My wife is a good example of why we got much more involved. We came together at Denison University in Granville, Ohio, as co-presidents of the student body. On those days at Granville, they elected in two elections, the male candidate and the female candidate, two separate elections. We were brought together by politics. Before long, we were in a romance, and I gave my fraternity pin to Char, and we were married a couple of years later and have 60 years of wonderful marriage. But it really came from both of our having an interest in taking leadership positions and taking responsibility. As I have mentioned earlier, during the Oxford time, I had an opportunity to think about it much more seriously. I met with a lot of other very, very bright people from the United States and elsewhere in the world. I really had some idea. This was enhanced by the tutelage of Admiral Burke and the others in the Navy, for that matter. When I got back and I was really struggling with the family business and the farm, which I still operate really in behalf of our family in Marion County, I had to put politics aside for a while, but people on the west side of Indianapolis, near our factory at Thomas L. Green, came to the factory one day and said, "Luger, you've got to run for the school board. Our kids are getting the short end of the stick out here on the west side. Nobody cares for them. And you've got to run." I never thought about the school board, to be truthful. Was not really sure where they met. But I was moved by that experience, decided to do it. My wife, Char, very wisely said, "Our boys are all going to go to the public schools. We better find out what's going on." And we did. It was quite an election. The leading candidate was Gertrude Page, an African-American lady who got the most votes. I got the second most. We became partners in trying to help desegregate the Indianapolis public schools that had been racially segregated from the Klan onward, and to get some breakfast programs going for latchkey children that went to school without any breakfast and so forth and were sick, other things of this variety. It was a very different agenda than I ever would have anticipated in my first public life and first election. But it led, many will feel, to my becoming the Republican nominee for mayor 3 years later and winning and having two terms in which we then got deeply into the UNIGOV experience, persuading the legislature to have one mayor, one council for Marion County for all of us there. Indianapolis elevated to the 10th largest city in the country at that point. We became a fulcrum for international visitors. It was an exciting period. It never happened again in a large northern city. The politics were too difficult. But I remember talking to the people down at the Tourism Bureau, Visit Indy in Indianapolis, and they said, "At the time you came in, Dick, the last hotel was being taken down in Indianapolis." Now, from that point onward, now through five great mayors, why, we have $4 billion worth of business. We've got 70,000 people employed in tourism and in visitor and hotel business and so forth. A vibrant downtown. And I would just say simply, these were all experiences, one after another, that led to an interest in politics and public life.
What lessons, because you did serve, you were a school board member, then you were a mayor, and you actually, as you pointed out, because you became mayor at a pretty young age. I mean, you were not yet
35
years old, and you looked, to be frank, in those days even younger than 35. A lot of those photos really made you look young. And then went to the U.S. Senate. If I could, what were the lessons you learned, the most important ones, from each of those experiences? Let's start with the school board, then go to mayor, and then the Senate.
I think the first lesson was that it was a remarkable opportunity to bring about constructive change, to listen to other people so we so understood, really, what the major problems were, and then to have the courage of conviction and the ability to research the alternatives, and then the ability to persuade others to be able to write about it, to speak about it, to be on the media and talk about it. In essence, these were all elements, I found, of effectiveness and of change.
Were you, and I'll say this, you had probably the single worst luck of anyone, I think, ever declaring a presidential candidacy. I mean, I remember I covered it. I was a newspaper reporter at that time. To set the backdrop, you were going to announce your candidacy to run in the 1996 election. Your announcement, which was going to be at the City Market in Indianapolis, was overshadowed by the Oklahoma City bombing early that morning. Could you talk through what was in your mind? Because the presidency, how long had you been interested in being president? And let's start with that. How long had you been interested in being president?
Well, at that particular time, for several months, I had thought about a presidential campaign, largely because it was not clear to me that there was a candidate that was likely to be the favorite, that was almost inevitable because of a previous run. I calculated incorrectly. Bob Dole really was that person, but it appeared to me on the Senate floor, Bob was not as interested in running as being majority leader of the United States Senate and was not really eager to campaign or to be active in that respect. But there were others on the Senate floor. I remember Lamar Alexander, who was still serving, a senator from Tennessee, was one who was very active. Phil Graham from Texas. Several of us were interested. So I would say, first of all, it appeared to me that if I was ever going to take a race of that kind, this was the best opportunity. You're right, however, that right off the bat, we were almost quashed by the tremendous change of interest in the media, certainly not in my candidacy in Indianapolis, not for days or really for weeks as things went on. But nevertheless, I went ahead with it anyway. We campaigned throughout Iowa, and New Hampshire, of course, but also the other New England states, other places where there were going to be early primaries. And it was really a good experience. My wife, Char, enjoyed it thoroughly. She often campaigned separately where I couldn't be. And it was very invigorating for our family. Ultimately, it appeared to me it was clear that Bob Dole was going to be the candidate, and there was no need to persist with this forever. And so I withdrew after a fairly successful primary for me in Vermont. That was my best showing at that point, which I think was still only 14 or 15%, but at the same time, we got some votes. But it was a great experience.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. This is a special broadcast, so we're not taking phone calls, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Finding us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So I asked Senator Tom Daschle, former Senator Tom Daschle, whom we're also talking with for the documentary, to envision what a Lugar presidency would have looked like. I'm going to ask you the same question. What kind of president did you want to be? What were the big goals that you wanted to accomplish if you had been able to make it to the White House?
To be truthful, I cannot remember off the top of my head all of the things that were on my mind at the time, but I was deeply interested in the security of our country, in our foreign policy, our military policy, to make certain really that proper attention was being given to that. I was deeply interested as someone who had been involved in trying to, first of all, save a family business and then manage one after we had saved it, as well as in agriculture. I had served from the beginning of my Senate career on the Agriculture Committee. And so the whole area of farming and forestry, the export trade that was so important to us in that respect, these were important issues that I talked about from my own personal experience as well as those that were important to our country.
Was it a significant disappointment that you weren't able to make it further?
Well, not really. I began to understand as the months and weeks went on what was likely to occur, and simply to enjoy the experience rather than to be in a situation of being despondent or depressed by it. Obviously, if you spend several months campaigning around the country and at the same time getting back to Washington frequently to cast your roll call votes, to do your duty, I think one of the differences between that campaign and recent ones, I remember when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were running as senators. They didn't spend much time around the Senate. They were out there doing their thing. That was really true for Bob Dole and Howard Baker, who were very close friends. They were very conscientious about doing their Senate duties, and it is so conscientious, I'm afraid, that it was very costly to any possibilities they had of being nominated. And that was certainly true for me.
I'm going to ask this next question. I want to get at, you've always been invested in trying to inculcate, grow the next generation of leadership. The former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith says that you wrote him a letter encouraging him to go into public service when he was a high school student at Brooklyn High School, and that he carried it around with him for years as an inspiration. Where did that come from? Where did that impulse come from?
I was always excited about the future and the possibilities of future leaders. I knew how fortunate I had been to have so many persons who had been very helpful to me from the time that I was a Boy Scout, trying to become an Eagle Scout, as I was trying to be a junior minister in the Methodist Church. I went through a period of that sort of several different career options, safely. But I always was very fortunate to have persons who really were great guides and were great inspirers to think ahead, to dream, to do more. And I'm grateful for that. I wanted to be that kind of a person for young people that I saw had talent, and that's still my goal. I've tried through our intern programs all the time that I was in the United States Senate, and now even at our Lugar Center, to bring people into our circuit, into our orbit. It was a real pleasure the other day to have an opportunity to be with our new senator from Indiana and to know that we had a good time together when he served in our staff for a period of time. And Senator Young will do a great job, and I want to continue to encourage him.
We are talking with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar on No Limits today. We're broadcasting live from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Because this is a special broadcast, we're not taking phone calls, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, my guest is former Indiana Senator Richard Lugar. We're in the middle of what is an in-depth and informative conversation about his life and career. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're in the middle of a lively conversation with former Indiana U.S. Senator Richard Lugar. We're broadcasting live from NPR's splendid studios in Washington, D.C. Because this is a special broadcast, we're not taking calls, but you can connect with us via social media. You can find us at Facebook, on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Chad has done and send us an email. You can do that by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Chad writes, "Greetings from a snowy Elkhart County. What is one piece of advice you would give to President-elect Trump in regards to foreign policy?" And then he concludes, "Senator Lugar, thank you for your service to our country and the great state of Indiana. God bless you and your family."
Well, I thank you, Chad, for your very thoughtful words. There's all sorts of advice that I would like to give to the president, but I would suspect that the first part really deals with the security of our country. And by that I mean the president must understand the problems of nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, the problems of cyber warfare we've been talking about in this program today, the importance of relationships with a whole myriad of countries who have a variety of ambitions of their own. This is going to require an education that he'll have to be doing sort of on the run. Opportunities really to study, to sit back with a good number of people who know a lot about all of these things, is probably not present for him currently. And therefore, he'll have to surround himself with people with whom he has confidence and who know a lot about it. Now, I don't deny for a moment that President-elect Trump has extraordinary knowledge of the world from his own business relationships, from his travels, from his extensive contacts with a myriad of people all over the earth. And he has impressions from all of this. But at the same time, the President of the United States has to be very thoughtful about his language, about what he has to say, about words that are going to be taken literally by people in other countries, and they'll either be warm or unhappy, as the case may be, or angry or disassociate from us altogether. This is going to take some doing on his part for a self-education in a hurry.
Does it concern you that he has expressed reluctance to sit for the daily security briefings?
Yes, I'm sorry that he's not doing at least a minor part of that educational experience. Now, you can say, well, those briefings are redundant. They may cover the same country day after day if something is going on. In other words, he has to be thoughtful about the use of his time, and I understand that. But at the same time, it would be very, very important during a period where he is not yet in the responsibility of being president to do a little self-education, to take at least the opportunity to hear from people who know a lot about certain things.
So I want to talk about the other thing, refrain, that I have heard in talking to other people about you and the significance of your career, is they keep coming back to the same word over and over again, and that is relationships, that you are a master at building and maintaining relationships. I'm going to ask a deceptively simple question, but I suspect it's not an easy one. How do you do that? How did you do that?
Well, I looked forward always to meeting people who knew much more about things than I did, who wanted to be helpful, or sometimes simply people who were in need, who wanted at least help from me for a variety of reasons. And so a variety of relationships come from these experiences, which I've tried to stay alive. We've just been through the Christmas card season, for example, and this is always a glorious time for Shar and for me because we hear from hundreds of people all over the country and the world with whom we have been in touch over the course of the years and try to stay in touch. And we try to learn much more and about their children and their grandchildren and their experiences, and really arrange opportunities as we visit other parts of the country or elsewhere to see them, to physically have an opportunity to be together. This has been one of the happiest aspects of our lives, this very wonderful, beautiful circle of people, starting with our own four boys, our 13 grandchildren. We have now 12 great-grandchildren as another generation comes on. We have family gatherings frequently. We are close to the teams that the boys or the girls are playing on. These are all important, but they lead, of course, to other relationships with all the folks that are involved with our children, our grandchildren, our sons, who are very talented people.
How did you go about, perhaps the outside of your family, the partnership you're most famous for, is the partnership you developed with former U.S. Senator from Georgia, Sam Nunn. And the two of you are the parents of Nunn Lugar, which greatly reduced the nuclear threat in the world in our lifetimes, which those of us of a certain age did not think was possible. At one point, how did you go about developing that partnership with him?
Well, it came about because we really got to know each other well in Geneva, Switzerland in 1986. President Reagan, feeling we were on the threshold of potential nuclear talks with the former Soviet Union, asked about 16 members of Congress, as I recall, 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans, the leaders of the Congress, or the Senate at that point, because you need a two-thirds vote in the Senate. He knew, thinking ahead in a bipartisan way. As it turned out, that was not the year in which the negotiations were going to move. But I got to know Sam well during that period of time. We went over to the Russian consulate together. We did some other things of that sort. And this led really to 5 years of partnership as we traveled during recesses to various parts of Russia or the world, noting the breakup of the Soviet Union as it was occurring. When it did occur in 1991, and Russians came to us and said, you've got to help us, but you've got to help yourselves because our people are deserting, who are guarding the weapons that are aimed at you and so forth. This initiated really the structure of the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Act, and within a few weeks of time, with the help of a lot of people, we got that passed just about a month before the Soviet Union collapsed. I've been through all these facts recently because we've been celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Nunn-Lugar Act this year in Congress, back at Indiana University, at other places, sort of recalling who did what and when. But ever since that point, Sam, of course, left the Senate after a while. I was left to get the money each year, the appropriation bill, to keep it all going. But he started this nuclear threat initiative that we talked about earlier. This has kept both of us together throughout the years and kept meetings going on with other people from other nations and other constructive activities in which we would write op-eds for newspapers or appear together in speeches around the country.
Your wife, when I talked with her yesterday, expressed a little mild frustration, saying that, in part because Nunn-Lugar was so significant, it overshadows the many other things that you've been doing through the years. And she said, no one has any idea just how many different places he's worked to make a difference and with how many different people. I remember having a conversation with one of your Senate colleagues from Indiana, Evan By. I think it was about the time that that President Obama was going to take office. And there was speculation at the time that you might be offered the Secretary of State's position. But Senator By said, he really, Dick Lugar does not need to be Secretary of State. His views are going to be heard because he is almost like a caucus of one. Everyone trusts him. Everyone respects him. Normally, that's a good thing, but an argument can be made that you paid a serious political price for being willing to work with other people. Is that the way you saw it?
Perhaps, and I don't want to describe all of the reasons that my campaign for re-election was unsuccessful 4 years ago, but there came a time in which our bipartisan index indicates that the Congress was becoming more partisan year by year. Other groups arose, so-called Tea Party groups, a Club for Growth or Freedom Works or various sources of outside money that were really determined to fashion a specific agenda. This was not to be compromised. It was they had scorecards, and each one of us were rated on how well we fit in with their particular agendas. And those that fit got a lot of support and money and organization, and those that didn't were criticized. I suppose that was just simply a period I had the misfortune of being a candidate for re-election, because there was certainly a build-up, a feeling that I was not Republican enough, not conservative enough, not whatever enough may be, at least as these various scorecards were presented. And so I could argue that I was responsible with Pat Roberts of Kansas State for the Freedom of Farm Act, which had made a huge difference in agriculture in our country, quite apart from these arms control affairs or all of the various treaties that we'd negotiated and so forth. But that was of very little interest if you were had a scorecard that did not have anything to do with arms control or foreign policy or agriculture policy or these various situations. I think times like that simply come, and I accept the fact that this was one of them.
Got an email from a listener named Bob, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. It's on point here. What is the solution to Citizens United and campaign financing, and how much does this affect the functioning of Congress?
Eventually, I'm hopeful, and I'm not certain I can describe the legal framework of this, but that the Citizens United case, which came before the Supreme Court, which has made it possible for almost unlimited contributions to be made to every campaign all over the country by persons or groups that have great wealth, this seems to me needs to be changed. Now, I'm not one who would deny people who say, well, our First Amendment right, freedom of speech, could be expressed in money. We ought to have the ability to use our money if we have it or to get more. But it's creating havoc, I believe, with the election systems of our country. Not just at the presidential level or the congressional level, but at local levels. And so I believe that it'll be the best judgment in due course of presidents or the Congresses, others to come along, really, to bring about change. Now, whether that will come through a specific court case or a constitutional amendment or how one wants to do it, I don't really want to prescribe. But I think it's very, very necessary for the future of our democracy.
Was it I'm asking a question that I'm assuming it was difficult. You'd served in the Senate for 36 years. You'd helped decrease the number of nuclear threats that we all faced. You'd pushed through an incredible string of legislative accomplishments. And after that time, your own party kind of pushed you to the side. That had to have been painful.
Yes, I was very sad that time that we really suffered a bit. But at the same time, I took the position that I've been a very fortunate man to have had 36 remarkable years for an adventure of a lifetime, literally. It was something that I enjoyed. It broadened my own views, but it led to so many wonderful friendships with people in Indiana and all over the United States and all over the world, which continue. And so I would like to have continued my work in the Senate. I certainly had a lot of things that I still wanted to accomplish at that point, but I accepted the fact that was not to be and that I would need to continue my work in some other capacity. And this is what has led to our creation of the Lugar Center, our holding together of a number of very gifted staff members and other friends who are doing really some great work, who are organizing situations. Recently, for example, our Lugar Center organized a speakers series in which we invite all the ambassadors of the world in Washington to come to hear people. We've had General Petraeus as our first speaker. We've had Alea Kagan, the Supreme Court Justice, as our second speaker. We're going to have Susan Collins, the Senator from Maine, as our third speaker. And so as a result, we're able really to stay in touch with people who are making vital decisions for our country and all around the world. And I like that opportunity.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't say we have gotten a massive number of emails that all operate on the same theme, and that is they want to thank you for your service to the state and to the country and the world and express their gratitude for your leadership. I can't read them all because we're about to run out of time. And in that spirit, I guess I would ask, because people have a tremendous amount of respect and concern for you, what do you ever relax, and what do you do when you do relax?
I take walks. This is a very modern way of looking at it, but listeners may express the same thing. I have a Fitbit on my wrist and sort of gauge how many steps, what kind of blood count we've got, all the rest of it. But in any event, in addition to being physically active and attempt really to do that, I just love to walk and to see things, to think aloud, in my own mind at least, while I'm doing that. It's a wonderful way of relaxing. The other way is, of course, to work with my grandchildren in all sorts of activities. Now, some that are a bit older are pretty active folks. Some that are younger really need more attention and help. But these are great sources of joy.
That will have to be the last word, I think. Senator Lugar, thank you very much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for allowing me to have it. I appreciate it.
Certainly. I also would like to thank the splendid NPR crew, Emily Dagger and her team here in the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., and our superb WFYI team back in Indianapolis for making this happen.
And I think all the great listeners.
And great listeners. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.